Hello, everyone, listeners and readers. This is Bob Fox from GreedAndMoney.com. Today, it's my privilege to have Neil Wei expert, alleyway expert, Glenn Neely here with us. Glenn, how are you doing today?
Doing good. I'm excited about the 25th anniversary of my super long-term forecast that I made right after the 1987 stock market crash. So it'll be sort of interesting to review that and see how things stand now and, you know, where things are going.
Sure. At the time, some of the readers and listeners were not involved in finance or trading. Would you mind provide us some review of the psychology and the market dynamic at the time in the late 1980s?
And obviously, you know, when I made this forecast, I was very new to the business. I'd only been in the business for about 6 years. And now I'm, you know, an old timer. I've been in the business over 30 years now, so it's funny how things change. But at the time when I wrote my book, I had written an article for Cycles Magazine. It was their special Elliott Wave edition, 1988, and I had presented in that issue a extremely long-term stock market forecast, probably what was then and probably still is to this day the longest stock market forecast ever made that I know of. It covered a period of about 75 years, so from 1988 all the way to 2065, somewhere in there. And for the first, you know, 10, 15, 20 years so far, the forecast has worked out really well. There's been some minor changes to my wave count stuff, but overall, the market has done exactly what I was expecting. It's been extremely strong and has gone way past levels that people at the time thought would have been impossible. I remember when before I did this article, I had done a talk, which is what prompted Cycles Magazine to ask me to do this article. I had done a talk in the summer of 1988, and at the talk, I had presented what was my, you know, long-term perspective on the stock market. Remember, this was after the 87 crash, so pessimism was worse than I've ever seen in my 30-year career. It's even worse than after the crash of 2000 and even worse than the crash in 2009. There was a lot of fear in 2009, but the fear of the world coming to an end in 87 was much greater than it is now. At least that was my experience personally. So the pessimism was everywhere. And at the time, I was the only bullish stock market forecaster along with Don Wallenchuk that I knew of in the entire world. I mean, everyone else across the board was super bearish, thought this was the beginning of a depression, and that was it. So when I made this talk, no one was optimistic, especially in the audience. And they were all assuming that, you know, we were going into a new depression. And so when I made this talk at the very end, you know, I announced what I thought was going to happen to the stock market over the next, you know, 75 years. And the audience just burst out laughing because they thought it was the most ridiculous thing they'd ever heard in their lives. And what I said at that talk, this was, you know, again, just about 7, 8 months, maybe 8 months after the crash of 87, and the market was still, you know, the Dow Jones was in the 1900 range. Hard to believe now, right?
Right.
And the low was around 1650 or so in the Dow, and that happened, of course, extremely fast, and the market bounced off that low. So the low was only two or 300 points below where it was currently trading. And I said at that talk that that low would never be broken for the rest of my life, and that was what caused the first burst out of laughter. And turns out that low was never broken. And also indicated that we were going to make all-time new highs in the stock market above the 87 top, and that we eventually go way beyond that, you know, even above 10,000. And that, of course, got another laugh in the audience, and people thought I was out of my mind. But it's turned out, unlike every other LA Wave analyst that I knew of at the time who were all hyper bearish, it was actually even a newsletter I remember getting started right after the crash called the Downwave Digest. and I can't remember the guy's name. I think it was, I can't remember his name, whoever started that, but it's called the Downwave Digest. And when I saw that, I just knew that, you know, if a person's going to create a newsletter where there's only one outcome possible, which is the market's going down, that they had to be wrong, because they, you know, that's just crazy to me. You know, trading stocks is about being open to possibilities and options, not just having a one-sided perspective. So he was locked in, and of course, that locked-in perspective ended up ruining his newsletter. But so it was a very pessimistic period, and the more pessimistic an environment is, the more likely it's going to be a low and that things are going to change. Same thing happened in 2009, if you remember how pessimistic everyone was, and then Warren Buffett comes in and buys up all kinds of things with all the excess money he had, and he turned out to be, you know, one of the best trades of his life, probably. So that's what the environment was back then. And this article that your listeners should have, that we should actually provide you, which you can provide them, and anyone who's listening to this should have access to this article, was what I wrote 25 years ago for the Foundation for the Study of Cycles. And I was hoping we could just review it, look at what I was predicting, and then make the leap to a more current assessment of where things stand, what adjustments I've made to the wave count, and then what I think is going to happen over the next 10, 20, 30 years.
Sure. Well, Glenn, well, I guess we can go through the article, and let's just look at the first page. The first page kind of give a broad framework of what Alleyway is about. Talk about
right.
the impulsive wave, the corrective wave. Would you
right.
share a little bit of those background knowledge to the listeners and readers? You know, what's the some of the foundation view of Alleyway in terms of the psychology and the price
yes.
action?
This is obviously just very simple stuff, you know, very basic. Just indicating that under wave theory, when a market's moving in the direction of a trend, it'll move in five segments. And when it's going against a trend, it typically moves in three segments. Those three segments tend to be, even if they're more than three segments, tend to mostly go sideways. Five-wave impulsive patterns always have to go comfortably or substantially up or down. So you have this big move, which is impulsive, and you have corrective moves, which, you know, go sideways for the most part.
Sure, sure.
And then moving on to the next page, I start taking this information and applying it to the long-term stock market data, which was provided to me by the Foundation for the Study of Cycles at the time. They, for a while, went out of business, and I think they're back in business now, but I haven't spoken to them in quite some time. But the long-term data that they provided went back to 1789, and that data carried all the way through to the high in 1987, of course, and it doesn't show the crash in full detail, but, you know, mostly it's there. So you can see the really big picture in the stock market, and
right.
most people misinterpreted this period. Virtually, you know, all wave analysts who had access to the data misinterpreted the period where the first advance, which is marked with the words first advance, was considered wave one, and then the period to 1860 was considered wave two, the peak
right.
in 1929 was considered wave three, the crash in 1932 was considered wave four, and then some people said wave four was in 1940. And then the
right.
third section was what most people considered wave five. And because
right.
of this long-term count, ever since, you know, the late 80s and all the way up till now, most Alleyway analysts have assumed we've been in this fifth wave since 1932 or 1940 period, and that at any time we could, you know, peak out this multi-millennium advance, those 200 or 300 year advance, and that's going to be the end of the world for the United States and for the, you know, for the rest of the world too. And we're going to go into this massive depression. And based on wave theory, if the 1929 to 1940, or I think it actually was 1949, but if that period was wave four, then the market should actually go back down into that range, which means it would go down to like 140, or and I've heard some forecasts for the Dow to go down to 40, which
right.
is, I think, near the 1932 low. I mean,
right.
that's, you know, you're talking nuclear war, obviously, if that happens. So it would
Well, actually, I guess it makes somewhat a sense, because when you really think about the turmoil in the 1980s with the oil price and, you know, and also Cold War, what's going on between the United States and Russia, and then you look at this chart with just some basic knowledge of alleyway, you know, any common person would see there's five way up. And but at the time, your interpretation is very interesting and very different compared to others.
Well, there was a lot of problems with this count, which I pointed out now for 30 years. I've constantly, you know, held the position that, and clearly spelled out in the article, that there's no way that that scenario could be correct, because it would require that the most of the segments that we're looking at or assuming to be impulsive are actually corrective. The biggest problem, if you look at the first advance, the pattern starts off with a lot of choppy, sideways, sort of volatile, crazy action before it actually starts to trend toward the end, and that's not the way you would start an impulsive pattern. And then the next big problem is the correction from the peak around 20.1 all the way to 1860 didn't take as long as the previous advance, and under NeoWave rules, corrections always have to take more time than impulsive patterns. Most alleyway analysts don't stick to this rule, and it's for this reason that most of their wave counts constantly have to be changed and they're constantly wrong. It's a rule that can't be broken. If you break it, you're going to have to always revise your scenarios. So as long as you make sure that your corrections always take the same amount of time or more as your impulsive periods, you'll have a dramatic reduction in the amount of errors that you experience doing wave analysis and a dramatic increase in the long-term accuracy of your wave counts and the stability of them. So that's problem number one, that what most people were calling wave two took less time than wave one, and that's not allowed under NeoWave and should not be allowed under wave theory at all. Then you run into the same problem for this next big advance, which most call wave three up to the high 1929. The correction after that for wave four also takes way less than the time for wave three. So that's another big problem with this count, which to me makes it impossible. Not to mention, notice during the middle second advance, there's an area that says consolidation towards center. Notice how choppy that is. In any impulsive pattern, most of the time, the middle part, or part wave three, would be the most trendy, accelerated kind of pattern, you know, phase of the pattern. Not the deadest, calmest, choppiest part of the pattern, but it's very clear from 1860 to 1929 that the dead period is all toward the middle, and the quick moves are at the very beginning and the very end.
Mm-hmm.
See that?
Yes. Yes.
So that's not possible in a third wave. And that behavior alone makes this count impossible. And I've been saying this for, you know, 30 years. So I've never agreed with this count. It's never even been a remote possibility. And when I looked at this pattern, I realized that the move from 1860 to 1929 had to actually be a corrective rally. Despite how big it was and despite the implications of that, it had to be a corrective rally. And if it's a corrective rally, then this was a far more bullish situation than what most people were considering. So what I started to realize is that the start of the United States didn't occur in 1789, which is where this data began, and that the progress of humanity didn't begin there, that, you know, London and Europe had existed for at least, you know, hundreds of years before then, but it was really making great progress even in the 1600s and the 1700s, which that data was not present on this chart.
Right.
So some people actually went to the trouble to connect historic information from London, and they were connecting London's data to the U.S. data. But I felt that was a mistake, because progress in one country isn't the same as progress in another. And so I thought it might give bad information. So what I did instead was do something that had never been done before. If you go to the next page, which is figure three, it's page 219, because this was actually the page number in the article at the time. But if you go to figure three, which is the next page, I actually had done what no one had ever done before. I actually projected backwards in time where wave one would have had to have started to make the rest of this pattern make sense, so that you have enough structure to have an impulsive pattern for what I marked as wave one up at the high in 20.1. Right above 20.1, and I was finishing around 1835. And then there was this ABC correction. And because the correction took way less time than wave one, I had to make sure the correction continued despite the new highs. So then we rally up to this X wave in 1929, which was a corrective rally. And then we go through this contracting triangle. And this contracting triangle is interesting because that's exactly the count that R.N. Elliott originally had for his wave count. He thought that was the contracting triangle, which I finished in 1949, and he did also. So I feel comfortable that, you know, the originator of the theory had a similar wave count as me, at least from the data that he had. He didn't have all this data that I have here, but he didn't assume that the 1929 to 1949 period was a contracting triangle. So that helped to conclude this very large corrective pattern, all making up just wave two. And if that was wave two finishing much higher than wave one and showing an incredible amount of strength, that meant that the move after had to be the biggest, fastest, largest move of all time up to that point. And if you do some measurements, you can see that from 1949 to 1966 was the largest, fastest move on this chart that was actually recorded data, not the part that I projected backwards, but was actually part of recorded history. And so that helps to reinforce the idea that in 1949, we finished a sideways consolidation, a contracting triangle, and we had this huge thrust upward, which would be the thrust out of the triangle, and the start of a major new stock market advance, which was part of this new third wave beginning in 1949.
I think, Glenn, what most alleyway followers who only have a simple knowledge of impulse wave and correct wave, I think that in terms of their mindset, they have the hardest time of getting over how in the world a correct wave can advance that big.
Right.
I think go ahead, sorry.
Everything is relative, so the size of it is irrelevant. You know, that's just a human emotional reaction. You know, in 1929, we began what easily could be qualified as a 20-year bear market. And in 1835, we had what was probably also another 20-plus-year bear market. It may have even gone longer than that. So you can have very long corrective patterns that go sideways. You can have corrective patterns that go up. You can have corrective patterns that go down. You can have impulsive patterns that go up, impulsive patterns that go down. It's not relevant how big or how much time it takes. What's relevant is how is it structured? That's like saying a building that's turned on its side is no longer a building because it's going sideways, you know, instead of up. So if a building is an impulsive pattern, you know, if you turn it upside down, it's still a building even if it's turned upside down. So a correction is a correction. It doesn't matter which direction it goes. It doesn't matter how big it is. It just matters how is it structured. And the structure of that move from 1835, where the C wave is on that chart, all the way up to the X wave, that's a corrective rally. Doesn't matter that it's big, it just is.
Sure, and also from what we learned in alleyway, that wave two tend to be a deep retracement of some sort before the strong wave three happened, and according to your chart, and that's why I suspect that a lot of alleyway followers at the time couldn't believe your forecast, because not only according to your wave two, it didn't retrace much, and we actually advanced the other way, which I suspect that it shows that the huge amount of momentum that's going to build up on wave three. Is that correct?
Well, what was happening is that the U.S. was the most incredible, industrial, money-creating machine in the history of the world from the early 1800s to the mid-1900s, that was perfect justification. You're talking about progress, human progress on a scale that had never been seen in, 10,000 years. So all of a sudden you were having an incredible number of new products being created, industrialization of society, patents, new technology. So that it makes sense that that was all a very strong period causing an upward slant to what would normally be sort of a standard advance. this was being stretched upward because of the incredible innovation taking place in a very short period of time that had never happened in the history of the world to that, you know, to that degree. So whenever you have new technologies that are life-changing and society-changing, that creates upward momentum in favor of the, you know, the trend. And so that's why the second wave stretched upward so much. It was preparing us for the incredible technological revolution that began in the 1949 period with, you know, computers just being created and eventually mass distributed in the 1980s and 1990s, and then the creation of the Internet. And all this stuff is building up incredible efficiencies and allowing for distribution of information worldwide and quick and easy access to things that never existed before, not to mention the efficiencies for companies that save them tremendous amounts of money so they can make more money easier and faster. So all this stuff is what's creating this upward slant to wave structure and setting the stage for an explosive stock market advance going into, you know, the 1990s, which I was predicting here, and eventually into the mid 21st century. So in the 2050 area. So this power that we've been experienced from 1835 to 1949 then transferred into the future market advance, which got us, you know, from 148 to 1,000 in just a matter of about 20 years. So that was almost a 10 times increase in 20 years. And then we went sideways for a while, then computers came on the scene, and then the market took off again from 1,000 up to, what was it, can't remember the peak, was it 2,500 or 2,600 in the Dow? Then we went through this, you know, the crash of 87, and then we went up way above 10,000. Now we've recently reached 15,000, right? So on this chart, we'd be up well above the 8,000 range. I'm not sure exactly where it'd be on the chart, but it'd be, you know, pretty significantly higher. So this is part of all this new technology creating incredible efficiencies and increased business high concepts and distribution of products easier and faster and better, and better record keeping and, you know, all that stuff.
And so, and I'm sure you probably will cover it later, but as an alleyway follower, I'd like to ask you a question regarding Super Cycle Wave 4. So after all those euphoria that supposed to happen in 2020 to 2060, based on the rule alternation, shouldn't we get a very severe retracement since Wave 2? It's such an upward slant correction, and Wave 4 is supposed to not only take longer and also alternate with Wave 2 should be a downward retracement of a significant scale. Is that a fair assessment, or you have other thoughts?
Well, Wave 4 hasn't started yet, most likely, or if it has started, it just recently started with the crash of 2009. We have to get into some shorter term and much more up-to-date charts to get into that scenario. This chart and this analysis was done in 1988, so most of everything that's happened that I was predicting obviously did not even exist at the time. But let's move on to the next chart. We can eventually move into those longer-term scenarios with more up-to-date charts.
Sure.
Let's move on to the next chart. So in the next page, it's titled The Long-Term Wave Count. I'm discussing, you know, the various phases, wave one going from 65 to 1835, and wave two from 1835 to 1949, wave three from 1949 to 2020, maybe 2060. So at the time, I assumed we were, you know, it's going to take that kind of structure to it. That may have changed some. Let's look at the actual wave count that's presented. On this chart, you can see where I've finalized wave one, show the flat for wave part wave two, the X wave, the contracting triangle, to finish off big wave two. And by the way, that two wave took about 160%, 150% of the time of wave one. So it did take longer than wave one, but not an excessively long amount of time, but it did take longer. The interesting part about this count, which is very common to running corrections, is at the top of wave one in 1835, if you take the length of that wave one and take 61% of it and add it to the top of wave one, you get exactly the peak in 1929. That would be a very common Fibonacci relationship for running correction. This is on a log scale, of course. So that helps to reinforce that as a good termination for a strong second wave that's drifting upward in a running kind of fashion. And then once wave two finishes, then it implies we're going to get a much larger advance in the stock market, which is what, you know, what I think we're in right now. So of the new third wave, we've already had wave one. We probably have finished wave two, and sometime between 2000 and 2009, we finished wave three. So we still have wave four to go, which is probably forming now, and a fifth wave to go, which is going to bring us up to much higher heights, and then a massive fourth wave to come later on. Probably that'll be potentially considered the new dark ages, potentially, but it'll be a massive fourth wave correction starting around 2060, 2065.
And that's my question. Yeah, and that's my question. I mean, based on the rule of alternation, and usually wave four takes much longer time. So that means if wave two spend about 140 years, based on your chart, you are looking at the mass of wave four potentially can spend more than 140 years.
No, I would doubt it in this case. Remember, because the alternation has to follow multiple different rules. It's not just alternation in price and time and structure and complexity. There's five different types of alternation. So with wave two being excessively long and complicated and powerful, that would indicate wave four is going to be probably quicker but deeper and more violent. So I would expect wave four to take maybe half or even less of the time of wave two, so more like 50 years, but it could be extremely deep and scary, and it'd be a really large correction, maybe 60, 70% of wave three. So that's going to be the scary part. Not going to happen anytime soon, but it could be very scary.
But at the same time, the scariest thing that at least American has experienced is the quote-unquote Great Depression. In some way, that's actually a correction within a running wave two. So what you're saying is the massive of wave four
will be bigger.
Be even bigger than Great Depression was.
Now, it may not be bigger percentage-wise, but I guess it would have to be if it's on a log scale. Let me just take a quick measurement here on my chart. I'm going to quickly measure wave four. On a log scale, it should actually look larger than that decline, but I don't know if that means on an arithmetic basis, percentage-wise, it's going to be larger. But on a log scale, it should be a larger decline. So, you know, when you measure things arithmetically, it changes things quite a bit. When you do it logarithmically, it's a little different. So percentage-wise, from top to bottom on a log chart, it has to be a larger decline, but I don't know if percentage-wise it'll be a larger decline on an arithmetic basis. But it'll be a very big drop, I can assure you that. But it's a long way from now, so we don't need to worry about that for some period of time. Now, we will probably start a big correction in the next, 6 to 12 months, and it could go on for quite a while, but it won't be on the scale of the Great Depression. We began basically wave three on my long-term count in 1949. We're still in it and still have a long way to go, and I don't see it peaking until about the year 2060, 2065, somewhere in there. Now, there's multiple reasons for that. It has to do with timing. Also has to do with some studies that I did at the time regarding population growth and when they expect world peak population, and the world peak population was projected, at least at the time I was doing this, to be around 2060 and to 2065. So since all growth in the human realm is dependent on human population, whenever you have massive population declines, you have massive reduction in growth because there's less people to buy products and less people to create them and make them and so forth. So peak population has a strong tendency to correlate to peak stock markets. And troughs in population relate well to troughs in the stock market. So that was another, reinforcement to my long-term forecast with a peak around 2065. And based on the time of wave one, which in this case I projected that it went from around 17, let me get my calculator out here, 1765 up to 1835. So it took about 70 years. We would want wave three to take more than 70 years. So that would be, hold on a second, about the year 2019 at a minimum. So I gave it another 40 years, which is typical because third waves, if they're going to be large, will typically be around 161% of the time of wave one. So that also gets us around the year 2060.
Right.
So for all these reasons, that's a good year to expect a super long-term top in the stock market, which, of course, is still, 47 years from now. So we still have quite a bit of time, but there's going to be a lot of ups and downs before then. Let's move on to the next page. This shows some of the relationships I mentioned earlier, which is very interesting, actually extremely interesting. You'll notice that the length of wave one, you take 61%, you get this 1929 high. And it looks like big wave one and big wave two are identical to small wave one and small wave two. So you have the rally up to 1,097 for small wave one, and then the sideways period and the peak of the 87 high is 61% of top above the 1966 high. So this creates similarity between a smaller time frame and a larger time frame, which is a very common phenomenon. Now, the count has changed since 1949, but at the time, this looked good, and the relationships were there, and it was still bullish, even though I'm bullish for slightly different reasons now.
Sure.
Okay, if we move on to the last page, and this was the controversial page, and I can't tell you how much flack I got for this forecast in this article in the late 1988 period. You know, I was ridiculed publicly, made fun of. People wrote into the magazines saying how stupid I was and so forth. But as it turned out, the 87 crash low was never broken. And clearly, in my high opinion, will never be broken the rest of my life, with us now at 15,000. And this article was projecting a move in the Dow to over 100,000 by the year 2060. And you can see where that little X wave is. That X wave is the peak in 1987. So this was written right after the crash of 87. And everything after that, that little triangle and the advance to 8,000, the correction and the advance to 100,000 higher, were all done, you know, projected by me. So this was what I was predicting would happen over the next 70-something years when I wrote the article, 72 years.
Sure.
Okay, so that's, so far, so good. The market's obviously gone well above 8,000, and it's probably up in the, you know, middle section of the next square between 59,000 and 8,000. Now, a lot of people, when they look at stock market progression, they always think of it in arithmetic terms, and they think, God, to go from 10,000 to 100,000, we have to go up 10 times. Well, you actually don't. All you have to do is double about 2.5 times, and then you're there. Markets double on average. I'm not sure how, you know, every, 10, 15 years? I'm not sure. Do you know? Maybe every 7 years.
It's a rule of 72, right?
Yeah, I think it's about every 7, 8, 19 years, markets double in value on average.
Yeah.
And, of course, there's inflation in there, which helps a lot. You know, the government's always inflating the currency. So, that's generally how it goes. So, you know, if you double every 10 years, you're going to get to 100,000 just in 20, 25 years. And that's just based on historical evidence. So this is a very achievable number, even though in current dollar terms and arithmetic terms, it sounds preposterous and ridiculous. And let me tell you, it sounded a lot more preposterous to say we were going to 100,000 when we were at 1900, and I was predicting that we were going to rally 98,000 points before we dropped 300 points. That's one reason why they laughed me out of the room. But clearly it seems much more plausible now with the Dow at 15,000. You know, optimism is pretty high now, so it seems a lot more believable than it did when I wrote this article.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, the most interesting thing is the power of compounding. A lot of people don't understand it. But math just doesn't lie. If you actually punch a calculator and it just doesn't lie. It works.
It's a lot more achievable than it sounds, you know, and you give it enough time and it's remarkable what's possible with compounding. So that's the big picture. And if you just keep an eye on this count for anyone who's looking at this article. If they can just sort of keep this long-term count handy. The only part that's changed is the interpretation of the price action after wave one in 1966. So I've had to make some adjustments of what's happened since then and where we stand, because the 2000 peak produced a big correction, and of course the 2007 high and 2008 period created an even larger correction, which was the largest since the Great Depression. So it sort of changed the way I'm counting this in detail. It does not change my long-term forecast. I still think we're going to go to 100,000 by 2060, maybe even up to 200,000 or 300,000. But it just changes the labeling a little bit here and there.